Welcome to the midday for a Tuesday. I'm Norman Gilliland, once again in our Buck studio, and today we have exciting music provided by members of an ensemble called Clocks in Motion. We'll find out where that comes from, and we'll hear some music by one of the leading composers of music in America today, a composer by the name of Steve Reich. I was in a meeting some years ago with him, and somebody asked, "How do you pronounce your name?" And he said, "Steve." Very helpful. Clearly a composer with a sense of humor and a very influential one, too. And so I'm going to start by encountering some of the members of the group here. There are four out of a total of six, is it, who are represented today. And believe you me, four is plenty to create a wall of sound here in our studio. So we're going to find out first about the ensemble Clocks in Motion, and that's going to require me to do a little walking and talking as they're going across through myriad instruments here. It's actually a bit of an obstacle course, which is a fun problem to have, because we're going to find out what some of these instruments are. And I guess we may as well start with Sean Cleave.
Hi, my name is Sean Cleave.
Well, I'm glad we got that part right. I'm glad we got that part right. And so why the name Clocks in Motion, and what exactly is it?
Well, we desperately needed a name for our group because we were going on our first tour about 4 years ago now, and we were still students at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and we were technically the graduate percussion ensemble at that point. But a member of our group at the time was a mathematician, Joe Murfin, who's played with us for many years, and he was looking through Einstein's Book of Relativity and came upon the chapter titled Clocks in Motion, which is an experiment which was used to prove the theory of relativity. So by putting atomic clocks in two different stations, one stationary and one at high speeds, the clocks were no longer synchronized when the plane landed. So we thought that was really poignant for the music we were playing at the time, a lot of Xenakis and Steve Reich, which really plays a lot with time and the perception of time for the listener.
So are you the clock that's going, approaching the speed of light and is moving more slowly, or are you the one back home that's at our standard human time?
I think each player and each audience member is a different speed of clock. And that's what's so exciting about it, yeah.
So let's get into some of the instruments before I forget to go there. You are standing in front of what?
I'm standing in front of a marimba, which is essentially a large xylophone that plays an octave lower. And actually the lowest note of the marimba is the same note as the lowest note on the cello C. So we have two marimbas here, and you'll also see over there we have two vibraphones, which is the metallic cousin of the marimba.
What kind of wood, I always have to ask?
Rosewood.
And what kind of metal?
That is aluminum, actually. The vibraphone bars are made of aluminum, and they're finished with a gold alloy.
Do they have, because they look smaller, do these particular xylophones have a shorter range, a smaller range than the marimba?
Yeah, the grand marimba has a 5-octave range, and the vibraphones have a 3-octave range. And the vibraphone's kind of weird because the range is F to F, whereas the marimbas are ranged C to C.
And what's the significance of the raised back row here? Are these, it actually reflects a piano keyboard, doesn't it? Like black keys and white keys.
Exactly. I think it's just a convention of the way the instruments were built, that the marimbas have the raised accidentals or black keys. I still call them black keys because they come from a piano background.
But they're all brown.
Exactly. Even though they're the same color, they're still the black keys to me. And then the vibraphone, everything is flat, so to accommodate the sustain pedal, there's actually a bar that can dampen and undampen the bars. And so the bars need to be flat so that the pedal bar can actually touch all the bars simultaneously.
And I also have to ask about, see, everybody has two sets of two sticks. And maybe I should find out how that works, because, I mean, it looks impossible. And so so we're over here with Dave? James, of course. James McKenzie at one of the xylophones. And so who came up with this idea? And it looks impossible, frankly, because you're holding two sticks in each hand and you're hitting with great precision both space and time keys that are kind of spread around. How does that work?
Yeah, that it takes a while. We usually typically start with only two sticks, and then sort of graduate as people wanted to play chords and do more with it. So now four mallet playing, as it's called, is very much standard for any keyboard repertoire that we're doing. Well, it depends on the piece. But jazz players made a lot of use out of it, being able to accompany themselves while in play harmonic content as well as soloing. And in particular, someone like Gary Burton, who might popularize a specific grip, there's various ways to hold it. Sean has his own strange way of doing it. I have mine, etc. But yeah, that's about it. But it's just a way of holding and manipulating sticks as you need.
And actually, yeah, that's an interesting point, manipulating, because you don't just hold them. You actually have to move them around in one hand while you're playing.
That's right.
Go ahead, show me that.
Okay. So yeah, we're always changing the intervals in very kind of fine ways just to accurately play.
Does it make any difference if you're left-handed or right-handed?
Probably, I don't know. Is it easier for left? I'm not left-handed.
We have a left-handed one here.
Well,
here we go. Hold on.
Just in teaching little kids percussion, it seems like left-handed kids tend to have an advantage because all the older repertoire was written with right hand being the dominant hand. So they get used to using their non-dominant hand from the get-go, and it ends up making their hands pretty equal versus a right-handed person only uses their right hand, and their left hand they have to really work to kind of make it even. So I'm a right-handed person. My left hand's still not as strong as my right hand after 16 years of playing.
16 years. And that is everybody in this group of four that we have here representing the whole ensemble. Clocks in Motion, does everybody play both marimba and xylophone?
We all play pretty much anything that is percussion related. So any concert you come to see will often have hundreds of instruments on stage. Sometimes we have fewer instruments, but we all, I think, have our fortes when it comes to playing certain instruments, but we all pretty much do it all.
You're Dave.
Yes.
Dave Alcorn. Did I get that right? Okay, well, before we get into our first piece, I'm just going to ask over here at one of our other marimbas, which is the biggest thing in the room here at the moment. This is Michael Koshevsky, and Steve Reich. Has he provided a lot of repertory for percussion ensemble?
Yeah, quite a lot. I mean, he's been writing since the 1960s for percussion. And he's still composing today. I think he just premiered a new quartet for two vibraphones and two pianos in New York City. I'm actually not sure. Is that where the premiere happened? Yeah. So he's been writing for decades, and we have just a plethora of works to explore in many different styles, actually, many different modes of composition and different emphases of what he was looking at rhythmically and harmonically. He has many different phases in his career that we'll be exploring in our upcoming concert.
Have you played with him, played for him ever?
I have not. Sean has actually worked with him. He's met him in New York and done some work with him, if you want to ask him about that.
Is that more fun or less fun to work actually with the composer?
Well, the circumstances in which I first worked with him was extremely positive. He was just great. We were at our undergraduate institution where I went to school, Baldwin Wallace College. A couple of students got him to come out to hear us play Music for 18 Musicians, which is just a fabulous piece, and the world premiere of Piano Face for Solo Pianist. And he came and was just incredibly gracious and gave us some great feedback, and it was really, really awesome. And then when I moved to New York, he would give me kind of backstage passes to go to Carnegie Hall to hear his group play, and it was really, really positive. He's a great figure, you know, not just as a composer, but as a person. Yeah.
So it stayed good. Okay, oh, yeah. That's wasn't too sure when you said it first. You know, it was
yeah,
a good experience.
I mean, I just haven't seen him in years. I haven't seen him since I think maybe 2006 or 2007. So it's been a while now at this point.
So he's still very much out there and influencing both performers and other composers. Just a word or two about the first piece that we're going to be hearing of the two, and who would like to enlighten us about that? Let's see, should we go back to Dave?
Sure. The first piece we're playing is Mallet Quartet. It was written in 2009, so this is a fairly new piece in his repertoire. And it's written for two marimbas, two vibraphones. It's three movements, but there's no break between them. They all move one right into the next. So I think he typically names his movements fast, slow, fast. So that's the progression of this piece. And basically the marimbas are hocketing a rhythmic pattern, and the vibraphones have more of a melodic line, but I'm going to be playing a line, and then James always enters after me and mimics what I do a couple eighth notes behind me.
Okay, and this will take us just past 12:30 on the quiz question and all that. And what's the name of this piece?
Mallet Quartet.
You have to let that breathe a little at the end, don't you? Let all that resonance kind of settle. That was a piece called Mallet Quartet by the contemporary American composer Steve Reich, from whom we'll be hearing again a second time during this hour of the midday. And the performances here in our Buck studio are by members of Clocks in Motion. We'll be hearing more from them, too. Well, we have a silent member of the group, at least silent so far, with us today. And I just want to ask briefly of Jennifer Hedstrom, A, what you play in this fascinating ensemble called Clocks in Motion, and then B, also, when do people get to hear you next?
I am mainly the pianist for the group, although this year I've been wearing more hats, so I play a little bit of percussion, but this Saturday, we will be giving two performances, and I will be performing with them as well on that concert. It's a full day celebrating Steve Reich at the Overture Center for the Arts in Promenade Hall. There will be a performance at 1 p.m. and 7 p.m. And currently, tickets for single concerts are $22.
That's as far as we go with that. But you got the idea. Tickets are available. And so you're the pianist, which, of course, is another percussion instrument.
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of times I do play the instrument very percussively.
Actually, the video is out there. And by the way, you can see a little bit of video on our website of Clocks in Motion. If you go to wpr.org/midday, and you can certainly see the instruments, and you can also, after the fact, hear this and any of our other conversations that take place with our performers during the midday. And without a lot of ado, why don't we get into the next of the two Steve Reich pieces, and this one is called Drumming, and I think I know why, Dave.
Yeah, so this is one of Steve Reich's kind of monumental works. I think of it as his big symphony. It's a four-movement work. It can span anywhere between 60 and 90 minutes long. Today we're going to be playing the first movement, which is written for eight bongos and four percussionists playing them. And it involves people standing across from each other and playing on the same drums. And it's all based on one measure of music. The entire 80-minute piece is all based on one measure, and it kind of stems from there.
So is there improv involved in this?
Somewhat. So Sean and I are going to be playing this measure, and then Sean is going to slightly increase his tempo and speed up a little bit, and we're going to pull apart from each other until it locks back in a quarter note later, and it creates a completely new pattern. And from there, James and Mike will be listening to our two parts combined and creating melodies called resultant patterns, and they'll be bringing out those resultant patterns and helping the listener hear new melodies based on what Sean and I are playing.
Well, I'm glad you've got it down. It sounds like you have it all planned. It's going to be a good thing, too. It's going to take a good deal of precision. So our second Steve Reich piece for the midday today, and it's called Drumming, and our performers, again, Clocks in Motion. Thank you. Well, in case you had forgotten, music fundamentally is about rhythm. You certainly can't make much of it without it. And in a sense, that was reducing it to its basics, a piece called Drumming by Steve Reich, played by the ensemble Clocks in Motion. But first of all, what kind of drums did you say these are, Michael?
These are bongo drums.
They are bongos.
Traditionally, yes, a Latin percussion instrument, but Steve Reich calls for small tune drums, and these just sound great in the context of this contemporary music, so I think they work well, yeah.
But we're not talking about just rhythm, we're talking about pitch, too, since we have a variety of sizes of bongos.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're tuned to specific pitches. I think it's G-sharp, A-sharp, B, and C-sharp. And these are this is a harmonic basis that carries through the entire piece, returning to the end on these same pitches on the bongo drums. So we do have to keep them in tune. They will rise if we play them for too long. So that's part of the challenge, keeping the drums in tune, because that is a very important part of the piece.
Well, if you look at a symphony orchestra or any number of other ensembles, you're seeing the person in charge of the drums doing a little tightening and adjusting every now and then anyway. So these skin covers on the drums?
Yes, these are our calf skin heads, right? Yeah. And bongos can also sometimes have plastic heads, but we like the warmer sound here on the bongos.
And rawhide.
And rawhide, yeah.
And you're just playing with sticks, or sticks, are you actually using both ends of those sticks,
yeah,
James?
You need both just a normal hard edge of the stick as well as a soft one. So we just use these timbale sticks because they're good, solid rods. And we wrap a little bit of moleskin around one end. And it definitely has a nice, softer character to it. Yeah, just like this. Here on the hard edge, right there. So you can hear that. It gets a little muffled, a little muted, so it's a really nice character change about halfway through there.
Okay, let me ask you, Sean. We've got 8 drums here. We've got 4 people playing the drums. How the heck do you know what to do?
Yeah, the score for drumming is quite confusing, actually. There are no set numbers of measures, and he only writes the pitches. He doesn't tell you which drums they are, so you have to figure out really how to do it. And so in the case of drumming, everybody gets a chance to be a leader. At one point in the piece, every different player has a chance to choose when the piece advances to the next section. So it's really more like a piece of world music where you kind of memorize the form and one person sort of signals when the next part is going to go. And rarely is that signaled by a visual cue. Most of the time you have to listen and you know, okay, James has advanced to the next section, so now I know the next thing I have to do is after Mike advances to the next event. And that goes through the whole piece. There's a whole section where there's 12 players in the marimba section of movement 2, where every single person on the stage has a moment to be a leader that says, okay, this is when we're going to advance.
And the leader rotates through in a specified way?
Yeah, in the score it does indicate which players are to advance at which points. But you really have to look at it. This is big score with all these different staves, and you have to figure out, okay, now player 3 moved ahead 1/4 note, okay, and then we can see where the patterns, where's the new downbeat. So it's like putting together a puzzle, this piece.
Well, this piece also, and I mean, it's not unheard of in classical music, but this also is a variable length piece. And so how do you decide how long to make it? And who makes that decision, and when do they make that decision?
Well, so today we did a shorter version. We played the entire thing, but James and Mike, when they do the results and patterns, they normally do a few more, so we cut a couple of those out. And just a couple sections that we normally like to last a longer time, we just didn't do as many repeats that time. We just kind of pushed things along a little faster today. So that was about a 15-minute performance. Ours is usually about 20 minutes, so there's an extra 5 minutes put into that exact same thing you just heard.
Is this one of the things when you play it in a concert hall where the audience says they might do in a jazz performance or even an opera, on the other hand, kind of gets all excited at certain points when things are particularly accelerated?
Yeah, I would hope so. For me, the first time I heard this piece live, it was a life-changing moment. It was the fastest 80 minutes of my life. I kind of just sat there staring bewildered at what I was hearing. And then next thing I knew, it was silence again. And you hear 80 minutes of nonstop music. And the way it progresses, the first movement's bongos, and then it seamlessly transitions into marimbas, which then seamlessly transitions into bells. And then the fourth movement combines all of them. And so there's just, next thing you know, before you even know it, something's changed, and you don't know how it changed, because everything is so seamless. And then before you know it, it's over.
And is there a long tradition of music that would be written just for drums? I mean, I know in the 18th century, for example, Denikin Philidor was one composer who wrote this, about a four-minute piece just for drums, but that's the only one I know of. Is there anything prior to the 20th century where you find just drums?
Well, the big pioneer for us is Edgar Varèse. And, you know, when he wrote Ionization, which we just performed last week, actually, here in Madison, but Ionization was a big piece, and that was, you know, that was at the turn of the 20th century, really. And then John Cage, about 10 years later, wrote a bunch of really important non-pitched percussion pieces, you know, where it was all for noise instruments that he just kind of had laying around in his garage. And then this piece was a monumental piece, but it wasn't until 30 years later, this was 1970, that Steve Reich wrote this. It was the first large-scale percussion piece. All the other pieces before that were about 10 minutes in length, you know, 8 to 10 minutes, and actually Varèse's piece is only 4 minutes. Ionization is very short. So when Steve Reich came out with drumming, it's an 80-minute piece that's carried all by percussionists. This was a big deal, and it's still important in our repertoire for that reason.
Well, when you mention Varèse, we think, of course, early electronic music, and some of this music that you play does have electronic components, does it not?
Well, we certainly like to use electronic components when we perform. We often use click tracks when we have really, really difficult rhythmic content to stay together on. So,
and how does the click track make that easier?
Well, we each have the time in our ear, especially when we're doing like phases, not necessarily in this music that we perform today, but it just kind of keeps us together when the audience might hear a whole cluster of rhythm that they can't really make sense of. We're playing very precisely together. It's a technique we often use to be able to accurately perform what's on the page.
You know, some of what you play, especially earlier on the marimbas and the xylophones, reminded me considerably of some of the gamelan music that became popular in the West in the 1930s, a composer like Colin McPhee or Lou Harrison a little later. And it's almost, at times, indistinguishable from that, it seems to me, in terms of the constantly shifting rhythms in a longer piece of music. What other instruments do you play in addition to the marimbas and xylophones and the bongos?
So the concert we just played last week, you would find anything from gongs and water gong and prepared piano. Jennifer was inside the piano tinkering around, a toy piano. I had cloud gongs. We had drum set.
Oh, don't forget that. Great. My guests for the midday today have been members of Clocks in Motion. There are a total of 5 of you, and we heard actually in one form or another from all 5 today, and we'll look forward to hearing some more. Thank you for joining us, one and all. It's been quite the voyage of discovery.
Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.